go out to all the ships at sea. Cable Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is A Streetcar Named Desire, showing Thursday, February 18th at 7 p.m. Winner of 5 Academy Awards and considered the first dramatic jazz score of a film, 1951's A Streetcar Named Desire remains a landmark which forced the medium into a new, raw, emotional, mature kind of expression. Again, that's A Streetcar Named Desire, Thursday, February 18th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fograng. Before we get on with the show, I have a short announcement to make. The Portland Folk Music Society is having its annual Sing Time Frolics out at Manuka Lodge up the gorge. And this the occasion this time, it'll be on Easter weekend, March 25th. And it's 100 years to the date of the 1916 Easter Rising. So the special guests will be Colleen Rainey. But everyone is welcome to bring their Irish songs, songs of rebellion, and have some fun. So that is happening in March 25th. For information, go to portlandfolkmusic.org. So now on to our guest. Ray McGovern has been retired from the CIA after 27 years, and he's really involved in peace efforts now and writing a lot. And so, Ray McGovern, welcome to KABU.
Well, thank you, Pear, and I hope that you'll invite me to the Irish Festival because I have a song to sing about the Easter Rebellion.
Oh, what's the name of it?
Oh, grace, just hold me in your arms and let this moment linger. They'll take me out at dawn, and I will die. It's a very sad song.
It is.
One of the movers and shakers of the Easter Rebellion, and he does die the next morning, and he does get wed to his loved one. And
was that Kevin? Was that Kevin Barry?
I don't think so. I forget who it was, but it was one of the leaders, and he came off the sick bed.
Oh, my.
And so did she. So it's a typically Irish sad song there, but I do, all kidding aside, take a lot of inspiration from what my forebears did and how they stood up to tyranny. And so I have a special affinity for others who are doing that even now as we speak.
Well, James Connolly was shot sitting in a chair, I believe, because he was too ill to stand.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like a very good event. I don't think I'll be able to make it. There's a song I like to sing now and then at gatherings. It's called the British Army Song. But I feel a little too ribald for airwaves and during the daytime.
Well, you want to be careful there. So.
why don't we get started with George Kennan and his presidential policy statement number 23 back in 1948. You know, a lot of people don't aren't too much aware of who George Kennan was, even though I think he lived to be 101 years old. And this statement was, well, it was a long statement, had to do with the world of politics at that time, but he made some very interesting remarks about the purpose of U.S. foreign policy.
He did indeed, Pear, and it's the kind of thing you don't normally learn in school. I never learned it in graduate school, and it really set the tone for what we're about even today. And it had to do with our emerging as the sole indispensable, if you will, the sole favorite superpower in the world, and that was not after the Soviet Union fell apart. That was after World War II. Make a long story short here, we emerged pretty much unscathed as far as our country was concerned. Certainly we lost a lot of soldiers. But compared to what Russia and the Europeans lost, of course, the comparison really is quite stark. Most Americans don't realize that Russia lost 27 million people dead, dead. World War II. Now, that's not just soldiers, that's people. That's the siege of Leningrad, the battle of Stalingrad. So it was the Russians really turned the Nazi war machine around, and by the time we came into to Normandy, which of course was a very courageous thing, all we needed to do was open up that second front, and the war was over, and it was over within a within a year. So what I'm saying here is that we emerged pretty much intact. Europe was destroyed. And so here's George Kennan, the master of Realpolitik, really kind of a practical statesman sort of guy. And he was inventing the policy of containment of the Soviet Union. In other words, they took they gobbled up Eastern Europe. They should not be able to go any farther. And that was, that was what was required at the time. Now, in 1948, he headed up the brand new policy planning staff at the State Department, and he wrote his first paper. And I'll see if I can remember from memory what he said. He said, well, we the United States, have control over about 50% of the world's wealth, but we only represent 6.3% of its population. So our policies have to be devised in such a way as to maintain that disproportion. We can't be sidetracked by altruistic values like human rights and other things of that nature. We have to do what we'll have to do, and by and large, it will come in the end to exercising hard power, period, end quote. That's not an exact quote, but it's pretty, pretty close.
That's most of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, here's George Kennan, who used to be one of my idols, really, because I was, my graduate work was in Russian studies. And here he is taking an incredibly imperial, incredibly, what's the word, kind of, kind of upper class white view toward the rest of the world. And if you look at our policies as they evolved since then, George Kennan, most people don't know, was also instrumental in making sure that the CIA, which Truman had envisaged as a analysis group to tell him what's going on in the world, Kennan wanted to make darn sure that if the Russians or the Soviets in those days were overthrowing governments, well, we need to be able to do that too. Because after all, it could happen, and it did happen, in 1952 in Iran. There was an election, a fair election, and a fellow got elected named Mossadegh. And you won't believe this, but he got this idea in his head that maybe the Iranians should share a little bit more of the profits from British Petroleum. And of course, when he started nationalizing things, the British came to us and said, let's British MI6, which is the CIA equivalent, let us show you what you do in such circumstances. And so with the blessing of George Kennan, and the blessing of Allen and John Foster Dulles. But we know what happened in 1953. Riots were orchestrated, and Mossadegh was removed. And who came in? A Shah, who brought in a secret police, second only to the Gestapo in the way they treated Iranian people. So that's the background of all this, and that's why there's mutual, we'll say, hatred between many Iranians and what they lived through under the Shah and in the United States. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch, but the whole thing had to do with maintaining this equilibrium, this disproportion, which came of our having dominion over 50% of the world's wealth, but only constituting 6.3 at the time, percent of the population. It's down to 6, and the wealth that we have control of is probably down to about 45 or 40% of the world's wealth. It's still disproportionate, but the time will come when even hard power is not going to work in our interest.
Well, I didn't know about this until, I don't know, a few years back, is that another government we overthrew was Syria back in 1949.
Yeah.
And it was an elected government, and the reason we overthrew this fellow, his name was, I think, Shukri al-Kuwaiti, or Kuwatli, and he opposed a pipeline going from the Persian Gulf through Syria, towards Europe at some place or other. And he also didn't crack down on the communists. So we got rid of him and installed a guy who did just that. It's interesting that this whole pipeline issue is still with us,
Well, that's 50% of the world's wealth right there.
Mm-hmm.
At least the oil was a major proportion of that. And it's still going this way. Not for too many more, years up there, but it's too many more decades for sure. Oil and other things being in eclipse and other things coming to the fore. But the thing is that if you fast forward to today, when Barack Obama gets up, as he has on several occasions, and says, we are, after all, the sole indispensable country in the world. Well, let me put it this way. I do a lot of lecturing in colleges, so I go around and say that phrase, and I say, now, do you all still do synonyms? And they say, oh, yeah, synonym, that's a like word. Yeah, that's right. How about antonyms? Well, I usually get one or two hands going, what's an antonym? I say opposite word. Okay, good. So what's the antonym for indispensable? And they scratch their heads and say, well, dispensable? I say, yeah. Think about that. Think about what other country, how they feel everyone being dispensable, but the sole indispensable country in the world. And, in too many cases we act like that. They see through it. And I don't know if Obama really believes what he says about this, but if he does, well, I suppose it doesn't matter whether he does or he doesn't. We act that way, and we're going to get our comeuppance. I hope not. Maybe we can prevent the worst of it, but the empire is on decline.
Well, let's. We seem to be dispensing with Syria right now, and you. I'm going by this. You gave a long interview with Patrick Smith in Salon magazine. And you say Obama is being kind of buffeted about, and it just seems very strange to me. I mean, regarding Syria, we dropped some preconditions for any kind of peaceful arrangement, and at the same time, you have these hawks talking for more war, and Obama seems to be. I had you say like a ping pong ball or something, kind of going back and forth on this. Where is he?
Well, I come from a family of lawyers, so I don't hate lawyers, but he's a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So you can see both sides of these things. You see that, and then he's like, oh, but that, He's like Hamlet. You really can't make up his mind. And so he lets these people make up his mind for him. Now, I don't see him as being very much in control in Washington. were he to be in control, you wouldn't have people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff yelling and screaming about Russia being an existential threat to the United States. Well, that's rhetoric that we haven't heard since the 60s, you know. And he has all kinds of people in the State Department and elsewhere who are pushing him to intervene yet again. I mean, you would have thought, you would have thought that Afghanistan, that Iraq, that Libya, you know, that those would be lessons that people would have learned something from. But here they are picking him on to send ground troops into Syria. To his credit, he's resisted that so far. But, you know, the guy is so, well, let me say it this way. Colonel Mo Davis, who is the chief prosecutor in Guantanamo, retired. He was asked at a talk show one time, "What happened to Obama? You were really big on him, Colonel Davis. You thought maybe when he said he closed Guantanamo, you thought that was the best thing because you saw firsthand what a travesty of justice that was. What happened to him?" And Davis says, "Well, you know, the only thing I can figure out is that after the inauguration, between Capitol Hill and the White House, his testicles seemed to have fallen off on Pennsylvania Avenue." Now, that's pretty graphic, but my goodness, the guy has shown very, very little courage, the only major exception being the deal with Iran. And that was due as much to his courage as it was to the ambitions of West Europeans and others who wanted to do commercial deals with this incredibly talented, incredibly rich country, namely Iran, 80 million people. So it wasn't Obama acting alone, but there's no take it away from him. He faced all kinds of opposition, still does, to the Iran deal, and made very good sense. So that's the exception to the rule. I don't know what he's going to do now. I don't even know if he's going to nominate somebody for the Supreme Court.
Well, we'll find out. In that interview, you bring up a sort of an anecdote that Obama maybe fears for his own life.
Well, he knows what happened to John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
The best book on that is the one I mentioned in that interview, James Douglas's JFK and the Unspeakable.
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
You know, this is just about, 6, 7 years old now. If you haven't heard of it or your listeners haven't, that's because it's marginalized and kept out of any review in the New York Times, Washington Post, any one of the establishment newspapers. But it's golden, and I've read a good bit about this. He sums up everything that was known before. He's read all those books. And he's profited from the releases from this congressional committee that has been tasked with releasing even more information. And he goes through it very carefully and concludes that in the view of what we call now the deep state, and that would be the CIA, the chairman, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, some people in the FBI and elsewhere, they were convinced that John Kennedy was going soft on communism. Now it's hard for people today to realize what that meant back in 1963, but that was the worst. That was sort of like being soft on terrorism right now. So, but they really believed, for example, with respect to Vietnam, that we had to send in hundreds of thousands of troops there. Because, China or Russians, who incidentally hated each other, would come down there, and before you know it, all the dominoes would fall, and Indonesia, the whole area would go commie, okay? Well, those of us who had some sanity and had relations with people who knew about these areas or knew about them ourselves thought that was, pretty crazy. What Kennedy was trying to do was to work out a deal with Khrushchev, with whom he had developed a very, very good relationship after both of them looked into the abyss, okay, looked into what they were being pressured to do, each by its own military. And it would have meant, the end of life as we know it there, and they knew it, and after that, they were chastened, And so they did the limited test ban treaty, and he did other things. He was talking to Khrushchev on the hotline. Nobody knew what they were saying. Kennedy had some people talking to Fidel Castro. Can you imagine? Intermediaries talking to Fidel. And, of course, the deep state learned about that. But more important than all these things, he had issued two executive orders, one which called for the removal of 1,000 U.S. troops from Vietnam by the end of 1963, and the other which called for the removal of the bulk of the rest of them by the end of 1965. So what that mean? He's going to give Vietnam to the commies. So there's lots more in terms of circumstantial evidence, but Douglas sets the scene in the first 80 or 100 pages, and it really sort of all comes together in a way that no other author has done, and I'm convinced that chances are he's right, chances are very good he's right, and back to your point, Obama probably has read the book, and Obama has also said, I think I included this in my remarks to that interviewer, you know, he was at a sort of high roller, well-heeled fundraiser. These, you know, just about 12 really, really rich people and sitting around a table. But they're also very progressive people. There can be progressive rich people, and there are, I suppose. So they're around a table, and they're really beating on Obama. And you're supposed to be progressive. Why did you do this? Why did you take them? So finally, he gets up over the dinner. He says, "Look, hey, stand up." He says, "Look, don't you people remember what happened to Dr. King?" Now, I wasn't there. And the source from whom I have this also was not there. But I have utter confidence in that source. I don't know his source, but I'm very willing to believe that this is a constant concern on the part of the president. Not only that, but he knows that NSA has the book on him, and on Michelle, and on the girls. I mean, they've been intercepting all this stuff all along. So there's that blackmail potential, and God knows. I mean, John Brennan, the head of the CIA, why he isn't fired? Well, he knows where all the bodies are buried. He can speak out on some of the things that he knows Obama was involved in that no one would want to know, for any Obama family, for sure. So, yeah, I think that's a factor. But I think basically, he likes backbone. He likes experience for sure. And he's a lawyer. He can't decide one way or the other. And, you know, it's just really, really sad to see a person who you can't really figure out, but the net effect is the same. He is what he is. And the policies that he sort of bends to, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Libya, whether it's now Syria, let's just hope he can hold the line on Syria. Because, you know, Pierre, the big game changer here was Russian involvement. And the Russians have bailed Obama out before. Most people don't realize that, don't remember that in August of 2013, Assad and his forces were dislodging these rebels from the territory they had seized, and it looked like they might even win, okay? Well, that wouldn't be good. For whom? Well, for three countries that hate Assad. One, Israel. One, Turkey. And one, Saudi Arabia. And so someone persuaded Obama to do this little red line. Okay, Assad, you can do these terrible things, but if you even move, much less use sarin or chemical weapons, that's it. I'm going to change my whole calculus, says Obama. The August before, okay, so a year before August of 2013. So guess what happens? Somebody uses some sarin gas in a suburb of Damascus. It's immediately blamed on Bashar al-Assad's government, even though we intelligence people are convinced that it was not Assad. It made no sense for him to do this. And the evidence is now more than circumstantial. There are Turkish parliamentarians who are testifying to the fact that sarin gas was shipped from Western Europe through Turkey down to the rebels in Syria. Now, you won't find that in the New York Times, Washington Post. try as we have to put it in there. Anyhow, what happened was they blamed it on Assad, and Obama was literally, a day away from pushing the button. The guided missile destroyers who were positioned in the Eastern Mediterranean, the French had put their fighter bombers out on the tarmac. And John Kerry got up on the 30th of August 2013 and said the sarin attack on August 21st, which killed 1,429 people, was perpetrated by the North Syrian government, and that's the red line. And you know what the president said, and so we're going to have to do what we said we'd do, okay? He said that 35 times. I counted them. You go back and look. 30. Okay, well, what happened that night? Well, that night, General Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, having been told by the British, hey, we got a sample of the sarin that was used on August 21st, it's not the same kind of sarin that exists in Syrian army stocks. It's homemade. So look, don't let the president get mousetrapped on this. The Israelis, the Turks, the Saudis, they all want Assad to go. They know that overt U.S. involvement in the war will prevent Assad from winning. And so don't let them. So what did he do? Dempsey goes to the president that night. Now, I wasn't there. I don't get into the White House anymore. But it's very clear from what the president said the following day. And what the president said was this. We're in position to strike on Syria for having done this act. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that's Dempsey, has told me that we're all ready to do this, but we don't have to do it today. We don't have to do it tomorrow or next week or even next month, that there is, quote, no time sensitivity, end quote, to this operation. And so I'm going to Congress for appropriate authorization. He startled everyone, including John Kerry, who had carefully laid the foundation for war. Now, that's to his credit. Now, what happens? This is sort of the bottom line here. Obama had talked to Putin. The Russian president, who is made out to be the Det Noir here, the new sinister guy, he talked to Putin in Belfast, where they had a summit in June 2013. And Putin said, look, you know, we don't want to have the Syrians with chemical weapons. The ones they have, they can possibly use. You know, I think we can get them to get rid of them. So, what happens? Well, we're talking the 30th of August, Kerry's speech. The 31st of August, when Obama gets up and says, so, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says, we don't have to do this right away. We're going to congressional approval. Now, on the 3rd of September, Kerry gets up before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he talks the same talk that he did on 30th of August. Bashar Assad has got to go. He's violated the red line, all this kind of stuff. And he adds, and the moderates that we're supporting in Syria are beginning to win. Now, that made John Kerry, not for the first time, the laughing stock of everyone who knew anything about what was going on in Syria at the time, because there weren't any moderates, and the ones that weren't there were without winning. So what happened? Obama goes to St. Petersburg for another little summit, okay? And Putin greets him, and Putin gets up in public and says, you know, I've read what John Kerry said yesterday before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and his words were, on vriot, on znayet, что vriot, это печально, which means, he's lying. He knows that he's lying. And this is very sad. Oh, now, he says that as Obama arrives for a little summit in Petersburg. What does that mean? Well, it means that they finally got together, and Putin says, look, don't let Kerry lie anymore. We've talked to the Syrians. They're willing to get their chemical weapons destroyed
on your ships, because you're the only people that have such ships that we take them out there and get them destroyed. And Obama says, yeah, you can. And Putin says, yeah, don't you remember when we talked in Belfast? And we said, now, a working group has been working on this, and the Syrian foreign minister is going to go up later today and say that they're willing to do that. Whoa, okay.
Great. Well, I hear our music playing, and so it's we're ending on a kind of a hopeful note, but it seems to me that things are still very much in the balance. So we've been talking with Ray McGovern, a retired CIA analyst. Thank you very much for sharing all this with us.
Yeah, most welcome, Per.
Thank you again, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia, coming up next on KBOO, your radio station.
That's right, Air Cascadia on deck here on the Boo, KBOO Portland. Then at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, today featuring excerpts from the documentary film The Black Panthers, Vanguard of a Revolution. And at 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman speaks with Lacey M. Johnson about her memoir, The Other Side, her reconstruction of the events surrounding a harrowing act of domestic violence. That's all coming up after Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to KBOO.FM and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Student Nurses Association Convention 2016, Empowered for Excellence. That's taking place February 20th from 8 to 4:30 at the PCC Sylvania campus in Portland. This year's keynote speaker will be Dana Bjarnason, the Chief Nursing Officer and Vice President of OHSU. Topics covered by the conference include flight nursing, forensic nursing, veteran care, public health nursing, and more. Again, that's the Oregon Student Nurses Association Convention 2016, Empowered for Excellence, taking place Saturday, February 20th from